You're now in the huddle with Coach Calls Timeout, the podcast that dissects the mind of a different basketball coach every episode. We uncover what makes them successful and how their story translates to your coaching journey. Let's unlock your team's potential together. Welcome to episode 24 of the Coach Calls Timeout podcast. Dan Jonker here. Here at Coach Calls Timeout, we're a basketball coaching resource. If you're a coach and you need a few plays or drills, check us out at coachcallstimeout.com. We have something that nobody else does. All our plays and drills are in video format, no still shots, and they can be downloaded directly to your laptop, phone, or tablet. All the videos are small enough files that you can send them to your players to use as a study guide, or you can use them during practices or timeouts. As a podcast listener, you can take advantage of our special offer. Go to coachcallstimeout.com right after this episode. When you're signing up to become a member, just use the coupon code PODCAST and you'll receive a free 7-day trial to sample everything we have to offer. Today we're lucky enough to have Coach Mike Cates on the show. He won an amazing 5 national championships during his 19 seasons with Humber College. He also coached the University of Toronto and was named the National Coach of the Year in 2008. He's since retired from coaching but acts as a consultant for multiple programs across Ontario. He also has experience as the assistant coach with the Men's National Program for Canada. In this interview, you'll get a clear sense of what it takes to be a successful basketball coach. Coach Cates never stopped learning throughout his career and valued building relationships with everyone in his program. If you listen back to some of our previous episodes, you'll find those common themes amongst all of the great coaches we've interviewed. There's one line that's my favorite of the interview. After it's done, I'll be back to give a quick summary and I'll share what my favorite line from Coach Cates was. See if you can guess what it is. As usual, at the end of this episode, we have another great story from Coach Steve Konchalski in the latest installment of Storytime with the Canadian Coach K. My brother Brian handles the interview with Coach Mike Cates. Let's get to it. Welcome to episode 24 of the Coach Calls Timeout podcast. It's Brian Jonker here with you, and I'm very fortunate today to have with us arguably the most successful coach in the history of the Canadian Collegiate Athletic Association, as well as somebody who's had a lot of other successes in the CIS at the high school level, spent time with our national program, and I'm speaking, of course, as Dan said, with Coach Mike Cates. And Coach, thanks very much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us here today.
Well, it's not that busy, but I'm happy to be here.
Usually where we start is kind of discussing the journey and how people got into coaching. I mean, you've been involved probably 40 years now. How, as a young guy, did you actually get into coaching?
I guess I first got into it because I played high school basketball, and I played basketball at the University of Toronto in my first 3 years there. And my fourth year, I chose not to play. And ended up coaching one of the teams in the Interfaculty League. So I think that was my first, you know, coaching a team where we didn't practice much. Mostly, in fact, we didn't practice, just kind of coached on the fly. But that's where I first got started. And a couple of years later, ended up in teaching. And what really helped me get my teaching job, I was teaching economics and other business subjects, was the fact that the school needed a coach at the senior level. So I said I would do that, and that kind of got me the job. In those days, even back then in 75, it was hard to get a teaching position, as it is now. And, so that helped a lot. And from there, I took the team and taught and did that for a long time.
And of course, you were at George Harvey there and then ended up at Humber. How did you end up making the transition from high school to the collegiate level?
Well, at George Harvey, a lot of our regional finals and city finals, in those days, only two teams would get to OPSA. So you were playing the final game that in the city of Toronto would be what is now known as the GTA. So only two teams got out, and back then high school basketball, at least when I started out then, was pretty big. So we would play our games at Humber College. So a number of our big games were there, and I think the athletic administration saw that we were playing, and an opening came up, so they gave me a call. But it sure helped to have played those big games at Humber.
And of course, at Humber, you spent 19 seasons there, won 7 provincial championships and 5 national championships, and also made 3 other appearances in the national final. I think the most impressive statistic for me is that in your 19 years at Humber, you were in the Ontario Final Four all 19 times. Is that correct?
I think that sounds right.
That's an unbelievable accomplishment. I know as a player, I played at Mohawk College in the early 90s. I was generally, for at least 2 of the 3 years that I played, I was probably, well, certainly the primary ball handler, but maybe even the only significant ball handler. I always hated going into Humber, and you'd have a different guy run at me for about 3 minutes at a spell, and by about halftime, I wanted to get on the bus and go home because I was so dog tired. What makes a successful program and one that you can have that sustained success over that period of time?
Well, the answer is pretty obvious. And, you know, you need good players. And and when I first got the job there, the team had just lost, and I think in the Ontario final. So there was certainly a good nucleus. And back then, you know, a lot of the recruiting it was local or regional. So we got a lot of kids from Etobicoke basketball, been in Malton, but mostly Etobicoke area. And, you know, kids weren't going prep school. There was no JUCO. There was no, you know, none of that fled to the U.S. So you got all the players who probably today wouldn't be playing at this level, even though I am working with Humber now, and I've seen the league this year. I'm impressed a lot with it. So, but certainly back then, we got the frontline players who weren't going south.
You mentioned the league today. I'm in my 12th season now. I think the depth across the province, the amount of good players there are is as good or better than I've ever seen it. Humber and Sheridan, the great rivalry that you guys have, is still primary. I think those two teams are obviously still the ones to beat, if you will. This year, I think we also have a Niagara squad that's up to the task with those two. And after that, there's any number of maybe 8 or 10 teams that are all quality. But the depth seems to be a lot better than it has been that I've ever seen it anyways. Are you getting to see many games then if you're back at Humber helping them a little bit?
Well, I consult with Humber and also Brock and Queen. So, you know, when I can, I'm speaking to the coaches and, you know, in communication with them, texting and seeing live games. So I've seen a little bit and looking forward to more. But, you know, so I think going back to your question, I think that from a coaching standpoint, though, you have to continue to, you know, enhance your knowledge. I know I was influenced a lot in those days by the coaching around me, which was very good. And so there's an ongoing learning aspect to, I think, overall improvement.
Let's talk a little bit about that. We at Coach Calls Timeout, we talk a lot about mentoring. So you're mentioning that when you were younger, you had influences around you. And now as a consultant, obviously you're mentoring coaches as well. Who are some of your influences, and what is the importance of mentoring at the coaching level?
Yeah, well, you know, that's a lot in that question, Brian. I think, first of all, my influences, as I was suggesting, were the good coaches around me at the time, guys like Wayne Allison. You could tell the coaches that were even back then, and this is going back to, say, probably 85, they were doing more than other coaches. They were looking at tape. They were preparing their teams for games. And, you know, back then, a lot of it was just, you know, you show up and you play a game. But the way that preparation and scouting has evolved at that level is, you know, impressive. But I was involved in some basketball camps with coach who used to coach the Lakers and Princeton University. His name was Butch Van Bredekop. And he was talking back then. I could now see much years later, he was really describing the elements of showing me some of the elements of what was known as Princeton basketball. Pete Carrill, but it was Carrill who played for Van Bredekoff, that got all that stuff from him. So that was a good insight, to me. I had gone to some basketball camps when I was younger. I remember going to, Will Chamberlain's camp in Upper, in Claire B in Upper New York State, and seeing how the game was being taught, you know, from the standpoint of individual improvement, development, they call it now. And, you know, I learned some stuff there for sure. So, you know, those were some of the influences. I didn't really have anybody who, you know, was older than I, who had coached, because I was fairly, I guess, young enough at the time. Maybe, you know, when I first got my job at Humber, I guess I was 34, something like that.
So you're talking right now about being a consultant for Queens Brock Humber. What, yeah. What does that entail, and how did you get involved at that level, and how do you like it?
Well, really, it's you advise, you know, you look at, you know, so many aspects of coaching, you know, your relationship with your players, your assistant coaches, you know, is the system you're running best for your team? You know, what are you noticing in games that maybe the coaching staff isn't, because they're so, you know, preoccupied with their own individual tasks, in terms of what they have to consider and do for as the game progresses. So I passed that along. I started that my first, after I left U of T, and I was working with Roy Ranafock. It was a good idea. I think he'd seen some of these, this kind of older coach idea with the people he knows in the U.S., and they were using some older coaches to sit on the bench. And so we started that way at Ryerson. I was there for 3 years. I was there a lot, but I was there at most practices. So, and I didn't sit on the bench. I was always, you know, sitting off the, on the other sideline and just noting some things and speaking to Roy at halftime. But that was a bit more comprehensive. This role now is less so that way. But, you know, some of the same ideas I employ, you know, from what I picked up, that what I saw was maybe valuable while working with Roy at Ryerson.
So you spent some time with Roy at Ryerson. You, of course, were the head coach at U of T when you left Humber, and you did that for 7 years. And at one point in 07, 08, you were actually the National Coach of the Year in the CIS as well. What differences did you find between the Canadian college and the Canadian university?
Nothing. Kids want to learn how to get better, and they want to enjoy the experience, you know, both practices and seasons over their career there. If you can do that, I think, you're going to be pretty successful.
Do you find that the style of game is a little bit different? Did you have to adjust to anything like that, or did you just continue on with what you believed in?
Not pretty much. Coach the same way, you know, the shot clock changed. I can't even remember, you know, maybe, you had to adjust to a shorter clock, than once was, but, no, you know, you got to run half court offense when you need to, and you're trying to get quick baskets when you can. And, you know, defense is defense. You got to spend some time on that as well. So, no, as I said, play, you know, I coach little kids the same way as I coach, you know, older kids. You have to give them an organized system and keep doing it until they get good at it.
What about time with the national team? What was your role there? And tell us a little bit about your memories with the national team.
That's a good question. I think what I got from that was with the program over 10 years. So, you know, obviously the best moment was when we qualified for the Olympics in Sydney, Australia in 2000. We, 99, we qualified and then played in the Olympics in 2000. And so that, that was the zenith of my career in that respect. But, you know, I had a pretty big role there, especially in terms of scouting. I think, you know, and back then, the way they scout now at that level, and obviously the NBA, wasn't the case then. I did all the scouting for all the preliminary play in the Olympics. We had one video coordinator, and Jay was the head coach, obviously. So I think I learned how to be around guys like Jerry Hemmings and a guy like Cody Herbert. I learned a lot in terms of how to scout a game. And I also learned the benefits of live scouting over, you know, just having tape to look at, even though people think, even with synergy and all the stuff that's available, there's a real, I think, importance in seeing a game live and watching players react to situations. And it's a little different. But that was, I started that with Ken Shields in 94. I was the apprentice coach. They were practicing at Humber College and was able to get a deal where I could take the year off from coaching at Humber. And I was also teaching high school at the time and went with the national team really for 6 months of that time for the 94 World Championships in Toronto. And that was my first insight into basketball at that level.
What can you tell us about working with and seeing the way a high-level athlete like Steve Nash prepared for what he did each day to be his best?
Well, it was. I think with Steve, it was like the way he practiced trying to get better. I think he knew, I mean, at that time he was maybe in his third or fourth year in the NBA, but wasn't getting a lot of time, had just been traded, I think. And I think he realized that he had to develop more flair in his game, or, I mean, he wouldn't just take jump shots. He'd take all kinds of fall away stuff. And he was really preparing for a better NBA career, which obviously he achieved. And, you know, he didn't want a lot of structure in terms of set plays a lot. So I think there was a balance there between what, you know, you wanted to call and what you just let a guy like Steve have happened as the game flows, and we did pretty well that way.
Where do you think we're at now? Do you still follow the national program? You still not necessarily involved, but you still follow and see where we're at, and where do you think the hands of our Canadian team are headed?
Well, it seems that we're still not quite getting the best players, the best Canadians, you know, that can play through. For whatever reasons, you know, free agency, having signed a contract, insurance, you know, there's all those factors. Close, but, I mean, if you look at how they're doing, guys are playing more minutes and playing better than ever. So I think the future looks good if we can get those guys to play.
Yeah, we've never had such a deep pool of quality athletes and players like we have right now. It's scary how good some of these guys are now. I think that's got to transfer into an improved national program at some point, even if the best players aren't necessarily playing. Although I'm sure everybody was a little disappointed that we didn't qualify for Brazil there, but I think definitely we've got to be headed in the right direction.
Well, I think we have, right? For sure. You know, there's always that other limiting factor is that the real good international teams that I've seen, that they've been together a long time. They've played together for, you know, 5 to 10 years. It's different here. We don't get the same practice time, don't play the same amount of games. So it's tougher. Basketball is a game that requires a kind of chemistry and understanding that can only happen over time if you're going to be as good as you could possibly be. And I think that's a limitation, but, you know, good talent and good coaching, even for that finite period that they're together, can certainly overcome a lot of that.
Let's go back a little bit. When you're talking about working or consulting, when you get an opportunity now to see younger coaches, what do you see that younger coaches are doing well right now, and where do you think younger coaches in general can improve?
Well, I think they're doing well in terms of I think they're seeing how the game is being played now and what kind of changes have been made, and they're adopting to them nicely, you know. And sometimes I feel that I can help them by perhaps suggesting the odd throwback possibility in there in their offense or defense to balance it out. Basketball, like a lot of things, tends to swing, you know, the pendulum swings, and sometimes we get, you know, we throw the bathwater out with the baby, so to speak. So, you know, I'm trying to, at times, just say, look, have you considered this possibility or, you know, so just that's an example, perhaps. But certainly they're doing their homework. I see them also, you know, some of the programs now have, most of them, it seems, have full-time assistant coaches that they can rely on and have around most of the days. And I think that's really important, you know, because otherwise you just can't do all of it yourself. That's a tough one.
And if you could point out anything that you'd recommend or see that maybe the younger coaches could be still working on and getting better at, is there any area that you'd suggest?
No, I think in the preparation phase, Canadian coaches have their players really, they, you know, they're a good job in scouting and game plans are really good. Sometimes I'm wondering if they're spending a little bit too much on the opponent and maybe they need to spend, you know, worry about your execution as a priority, even over all the scouting information that's out there. But no, they're doing a very good job, you know, and I think they're understanding, they got to do a lot of things. They got to raise money. They got, you know, they get their players better. They got to recruit good players. They got to see what's the best system to use. That's hard to do, you know, and the hardest part of coaching is, can you take your team and make it and get it to play as well as it's capable of? That sounds easy, but it's not.
No, you know? It's definitely not.
And that's what I try to do if I can. Is there something I can provide that they may, you know, that they're not considering or that might help them? That's what I do. And, you know, the consulting business is, you know, you throw it out there, and if they use it, fine. And if they don't, that's your fraud. That's what they're paying me for. So I just try to do that, you know, stay kind of detached that way.
What's the youngest ages that you see play right now? Do you have any grandkids that play? Do you have, do you get a chance to see kids at a younger level?
Well, I went through all that with my son. So, you know, he was about, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 years old. My grandson's a little too young right now. I'm not sure he wants to be a basketball player anyways. But, you know, the Raptors, I see these little kids. I saw a bunch of little, you know, young girls playing last week at halftime, and I was quite impressed. You know, they could dribble, they could shoot. It was good. It was good. So I don't think it can be too young. I mean, got to get out there and play, right?
Yeah. From a coaching standpoint, though, I was curious just to see if you'd seen any of the younger stuff, because, I mean, I've got daughters who just my youngest is in grade 9 now, so I spent the 4 previous seasons coaching her team as well. So you get a good idea or a good opportunity to see lots of young coaches, some parents, some, you know, some doing it to help out, all those different scenarios.
Right.
So I was curious as to whether you've had any exposure to that over the last little while or seen any people at the younger age, because I know there's a lot of those type of coaches that listen to us, and they get a lot of we're getting a lot of email with a lot of positive feedback from the high level coaches that we've had on with the interesting ways that they're talking about developing people and more the psychological part of the game, if you will, you know, bringing people together, bonding teams, the positive messages that you try to have, especially at the younger ages. How did you approach your teams? Would you consider yourself a glass half full, a glass half empty, a positive guy, an honest guy? How did you deal with your guys?
Well, I suggested a little earlier. I think, you know, somebody asked me that a while ago. You know, what is it that you can pass on in terms of, you know, how can you sustain, you know, a career in coaching? And, well, I mean, the way you do that is that, you know, that every season you're not full of angst and, you know, you can't wait for the next year because you can't stand this team. I mean, my formula was this. They want to learn, they want to compete, and they want to enjoy it. And I always felt that if you could stay true to those three aspects of a team dynamic, you know, and the collective over time, that can work. So if you break that down, you know, what does that mean? You know, one of the things it means to me is coaches tend to talk a lot, and players can listen. I think they listen for about 10 seconds. Then you got to let them get on with it. Make your point and let them execute that drill or continue the scrimmage or whatever it is. And I think going on too long, you know, then they start to roll their eyes. That's part of enjoyment, right? How do you make it enjoyable? Well, I mean, you or your staff have to have a sense of humor. And they've got to be able to see that. Like, that's important. I think you've got to be pretty, at times, honest with them in terms of who are you to them? How are you coming across? What kind of person are you? You know, at the collegiate level, I think it was important to find out what they're taking in school. What's interesting? Just talk about one subject or one class. Something that's outside of basketball. Those are things that I think really make a difference to players. And they want to get better, you know. Why aren't I playing? Because you're not good at this. Well, how do I get good at that? Well, here you go. Either you or your assistant, you get to work on that kid so that he knows, you know. And I think being honest is important too, Brian. I mean, like, if a player wants to know why he's not playing, you got to tell him.
Yeah, those conversations sometimes can be difficult, but you have to be honest, I think. You're doing a disservice to him and potentially painting yourself into corners if you're not honest.
Right. No, absolutely. You know, one of the teams I'm working with told me he took his team to a movie the other night, and they hadn't done that. And they had a good discussion after. Like, you know, that kind of stuff, you know? I mentioned the name Gordon Hayward. He had played with the national team under Jack Donahue a little bit. And I said, Cody, what do you remember about that time? He says, you know what? I don't remember the practices. I don't remember the games. But I remember the kind of talks that Donahue had with us as a team and individually that made a difference to me. See, that's really what it's about.
Yeah, we had Coach Konchelski on, and he worked closely with Jack Donahue with the national team, and Coach Konchelski said he was basically responsible for scouting and for preparing, and Jack did all the people stuff, and he loved getting together with the guys and finding out what made them tick, and that bonds and the relationships that he forged. Coach Konchelski felt that made the difference in how successful they were because the guys really wanted to play for him.
Right. And it's got to be real. It can't be, you know, kind of phony or contrived. But, you know, I think some of that, I mean, that's all part of it. But, you know, I don't know. It's how you come. It's like look, if coaching is teaching, which everybody seems to say it is, you know, what made a good teacher? He enjoyed the subject matter because he made it interesting. Well, you can translate that to basketball. That teacher would listen to you and had time for you. It's all very transferable to coaching, right?
Absolutely.
So that's what I would say to young coaches out there. And some, and a lot of coaches might have a tough time with, you know, with that. You know, I never believed in screaming and yelling at the team. To me, that didn't make sense. I would be angry, and I would express it, but it was never directed to a person, you know? That conversation's in your office with nobody else around. And then when you do it when it's really necessary, they understand that, you know, they're screwing up. They got to hear this. But if you do it every 10 minutes, it loses its effect, you know?
I'm extremely happy to hear that. I feel the exact same way. And everything you just said, I try to take that approach with our guys as well. As a staff, we're not screamers and yellers. I think, as you said, it loses its effect if you're doing it too often. So,
you know, well, that's good to hear, but I mean, that's just my opinion. But, you know, you hear a lot about, well, today's kid, it's not like it was 30 years ago. Yes, it is. They said that 30 years ago. You can't talk to kids like you could 30 years before that. I don't think you can ever talk to kids like that and expect some benefit, but that's just me. I know coaches out there and they told me, hey, Mike, don't tell me about this. This is how I go. This is what I need to do. Well, okay. You know, I guess it's your own choice, but that was always my feeling, you know?
Well, who's to argue with you? You got enough rings to show that it works. So it's, I'm certainly not going to argue with you. Speaking of rings, when you talk about your your greatest accomplishments or what makes you most proud over your career? Can you narrow it down? Is there any specific memories or memory that you say, hey, I really like this and I'll never forget it?
You know what, Brian? I don't really look back and remember championship moments. I don't. I don't even know where the damn rings are. I mean, I think I know where they are, but when I look back, how do I describe this? I know when our team executed well in a particular game or, you know, I can remember some of that more than whether we won or not. You know, to me, basketball in some ways is an art form. You know, it's like a beautifully choreographed dance. If your team runs a play and it looks good, that to me was the great pleasure of coaching. You know, it was an art form in that respect. You're driven by wins and you're yelling at refs and did a lot of that and probably wouldn't change, but that's not what you remember, you know? You just don't. At least I don't. But if you didn't have that one big win or championship, you'd probably think you were not successful. But I don't really believe that.
No, I definitely don't believe that because, there's certainly some luck along the way, too. Things have to bounce the right way. I think there's a certain level, though, where if you're, you know, you're doing things at a consistent level and winning consistently, I think you're at a different point than other people. And you did it for a long time. I mean, Dave Smart, obviously, what he's got going on up at Carlton is almost not human. But,
tremendous. What he's doing is unparalleled, probably universally. You know, and that story should be told from a standpoint of international basketball, not just huge in Ontario, Ottawa, or Canada.
So outside of what he's doing, I can't think of anybody else who had a run like you had. Ken Shields had a really good run too. I mean, there's a very small number of people who had the success that you guys have had. We wrap up every episode with something that we call Full Court Press, and it's just some real short one word, two word type answer type questions. And I'd like to wrap this up and throw some questions at you if I can real quickly.
Sure, Brian.
All right, here we go. You prefer the FIBA or the Federation rules?
FIBA.
Favorite gym that you've ever coached in?
I always liked the old Mohawk gym, believe it or not.
What do you prefer watching, college or pro game?
Always pro.
What do you miss most about coaching?
I guess, you know, preparing for a team, a big game coming up and you've done the right things and your team's playing well against it, you know, and if you won that game, that was always great.
And what's your favorite interest outside of basketball or sports?
Right now it's guitar playing and singing. I'm doing a lot of that. So.
Yes. I read somewhere that you're a bit of a singer and a guitar player. So do you do that very often?
These days I do. Yeah.
I should have asked you to get a guitar out and sing something for us.
Well, hard to do that in the car.
All right.
Although I've done it.
All right. Okay. I appreciate you coming on today.
Thank you, Brian. And continued good luck with your team. I know you've had some great success at Mohawk.
Well, thanks very much.
There you have it. Can you guess what my favorite line was? It's when Coach Kate says, "My formula was this. They want to learn, they want to compete, and they want to enjoy it." For any coaches who are listening, this should be in your mind with everything that you do. Ask yourself if you're creating an atmosphere where it's safe or easy to learn. Are you getting the most out of your players? Are they competing for you? And most of all, are they enjoying it? Your number one priority should be to ensure every single player comes back next year. I've played with and watched too many great players get burnt out because the game wasn't fun anymore. Did this episode remind you of a coach you've had or basketball experience you've shared? If so, we'd love to hear about it. You can go to coachcallstimeout.com/stories to share your story. We're looking for stories about coaches from all levels who are creating fantastic memories for their players. Help them get the recognition that they deserve and possibly get their story told on this podcast. Again, you can go to coachcallstimeout.com/stories to share your story. If you enjoyed what you heard, we'd appreciate if you could rate us on iTunes or share this episode with a friend or coach by going to coachcallstimeout.com/24. It really does help other coaches find this show. We'll be back again in 2 weeks to pick the brain of another great coach. But before we go, if you listened to episode 20 with Coach Steve Konchalski, you know that he's a Hall of Fame basketball coach who's been coaching for over 40 years. In that episode, he shared some great stories. He had so many stories that we made it a segment on the show. Here's story time with the Canadian Coach K. Enjoy.
If you can, Coach, with all the time that you spent with Jack Donahue and the national team, do you have a tale that you can tell us about Jack?
One of the greatest coaching moves I've ever seen Coach Jack Donahue make, and I was with him for 16 years, and this is my 16th year, and I think the background behind it is that we're in an Olympic qualification tournament in Montevideo, Uruguay, and it's the spring. I can tell you exactly when it is. It's mid-May of 1988, and Jack had indicated early in the year this was going to be his last year of 16. This was potentially going to be his fourth Olympics that he was attempting to qualify for. And many of the players, the Jay Trianos, Gerald Kazanowskis, Eli Pasquales, John Hatches, these players that have been were with Coach Donahue and dedicated to him and the program, you know, this was their third Olympics, or second for some of them, and this would have been their third. It should we qualify. Anyway, we go to Uruguay, and all of us had made sacrifices. My daughter, my youngest daughter was born during this trip. My youngest daughter, Maria, was born while I was in Uruguay. So, like I said, many of us had made sacrifices. Anyway, long story short, we get to the semifinal game against Puerto Rico, and a win there qualifies us. And we were a long shot to qualify because we had an older team. You know, people really weren't excited about us, but this was Coach Donahue's swan song, and everybody was dedicated to doing everything we could to qualify. So anyway, Uruguay beats us by 13 points in the qualifying round, but we end up with playing Puerto Rico in the semifinals, and we lose a heartbreaker at the buzzer in a game that we led most of the way. So now we have a day in between to get ready to play Uruguay again, last game of Jack Donahue's career, potentially as national coach of Canada. Last game for most of our players on this particular team, like I said, the Trianos and Pasquales. And we're down, losing a tough game. We have a day to recoup, and we have to play Uruguay in Uruguay. Like I said, a team that we lost to by 10 or 12 points a week or so prior. And the crowd is going to be crazy, and the referees aren't going to be on our side. It's going to be a challenge. Anyway, so we come to practice the day before the game, and instead of going through a game plan and technical things, Jack Donahue decided he's going to have a fun practice. So we played big men against the little men. We had shooting competitions. We had dribble tags. We had all the things that us as coaches all periodically put into our game plan, our practice plan, but not usually before the biggest game of the summer or Olympic qualification game. But that practice, that was a stroke of genius, how he approached that practice and set the tempo for the next 24 hours. And what happened over those next 24 hours was amazing. All of a sudden, a player starting writing notes to each other and posting them on our hotel room doors about how important his last several years were, how players literally loved each other and didn't want this to make it the last game that we ever played together. And the momentum, you know, generated from there. And when game time came, we got on the court, and the first play of the game, John Hatch, you know, a St. Evex player who was in his eighth year with the national team program, got an elbow in the head, and the blood started streaming down his face. And what had this was pre Magic Johnson and all the blood rules and whatever. And what Hatch did is he took the blood and he smeared it all over his face like war paint. And that was it. That was the game. And we were up 18 at the half, and we were just happy to get out of the building alive. And hey, bottom line, we qualified for the Olympics. But it was one of the greatest coaching moves I've ever seen. After working with Coach Donahue for 16 years, I thought I'd seen everything, but that wasn't the case. He still has some tricks, you know, to pull out of the hat and turn the team around and turn the summer around and extend his coaching career to the Seoul Olympics, where we finished sixth, and he finished his career on a high note.